pray for the third aliyah of Parshas Tetzaveh. We mentioned last week, I gave a general introduction to these Parshios and talked about how they're not necessarily as relatable as a lot of the rest of the Torah or as exciting in terms of the narrative of the story, but there are additional reasons why we'd want to pay even closer attention. We talked about how there's a possibility of fulfilling a concept through learning about it. We talked about how these are mitzvos which tend to be very symbolism heavy, and therefore there is particularly that aspect to get from them in terms of the learning about them. So all of that continues to be true. But I would also add on top of that, that as far as this week's parsha, maybe even more so, there's an additional element to learning about these concepts, and hopefully we'll see that specifically in the context of this aliyah, but it's true about a lot of the parsha, that when we talk about the Big Day Kahuna, and when we talk about especially what we'll see in this third aliyah, so we find that Chazal tell us that there are kaparos that are associated, that the different components of the begadim would bring about atonements, would help us to achieve forgiveness for certain averos. And in general, it's worth exploring how a kapara works. So the whole notion that any kind of a mitzvah or any kind of a performance should be machaper for any kind of an avera. Is that something that happens automatically? Is that something that happens as kind of a segula? Is that something that's totally beyond us? So what's most accessible to us within the realm of kapara such as this is the idea that a certain action of a mitzvah kind will help us refine our sensitivities and will help us reorient our perspective. And if there was an avera that we're guilty of that stemmed from a lack of sensitivity or from a perspective that was off, so then a mitzvah that corrects for that, that gives us a new perspective, that helps us to see things differently, serves to uproot whatever it was that led to the avera in the first place. So a mitzvah can be a kapara for an avera, especially in that sense, that if the mitzvah helps to change us into a different kind of person, the kind of person who, given the same circumstances, wouldn't necessarily have violated that avera in the first place, so we can understand how it can serve as a kapara. So if we treat it like that, especially if we understand that the nature of the kapara is not necessarily only coming through the key of HaMitzvah, whatever it is we're talking about, but is coming especially through connecting to whatever the message of that mitzvah is, so then that is an additional element that is there for us when studying this week's parsha, that even if we're not really going to encounter the Big Day Kahuna in our daily lives right now, but by studying them and trying to really understand what the message is that Chazal perceived in the various begadim and what sensitivities they are trying to cultivate within us, so the same way the begadim were able to serve as a kapara for whatever deficiencies, so too, by learning about them and by studying the symbolism and the messages that are contained therein, so we are able to also hopefully correct whatever flaws are in our perspective, and that should also accomplish perhaps a very similar, if not the same, goal, and should help bring about a kapara. So that's a tremendous opportunity that we have this week when listening and considering Parshas Tetzaveh and these psukim about the Big Day Kahuna, that if we really try to focus on what their message is, then perhaps the associated kaparas that Chazal have identified, maybe at least on some level, are able to affect us as well. So let's try to look at some of these psukim. So it starts off talking about the meal, about the robe. Nowadays, talk about a meal being like a coat, talk about robe. V'yasis es mi'il ha'efod, kalil techeles. So they would make this robe of the ephod that was completely blue, completely techeles. V'haya fi rosho besocho. So you have a hole at the top, safa yelefiv, saviv, mase oreg. And around that, there should be a safa that is woven kifi sachra yellow lo yikareya. So it looks like it was a whole of a suit of armor, so that it should not tear. So the language, it sounds like you're reinforcing it so that it doesn't tear. But the Gemara Maseches Yuma Daf Ayin Beis Amud Aleph understands that we should read this as a lav, as a losas. The Torah is telling us you should not tear it, and there are malchus associated because it's a lav. So that's not exactly how we would have been inclined to read it. It sounds like from the pasuk that it's reinforced so that it shouldn't come to tear. So the Gemara tells us that no, you can tell that it's actually an iser because it doesn't mean so that it shouldn't tear, because it doesn't say sheh, it doesn't say shelo yikareya. So it just has it as an instruction, lo yikareya, that means it should, you should not be tearing it. Although it is in the passive voice, it should not be torn through you. So maybe that tells us something about the nature of the iser, maybe that makes it even more expansive. So the Tshuva Beis Yitzchak, Reb Yitzchak Shmalkus writes, that it comes to tell you that the iser is even passively, even ayde grama, let's say, you shouldn't even cause it to be ripped. It's a more expansive kind of iser. But it's also noteworthy that this would seem to apply really to all the big day kahuna. So the additional reference here telling you not to rip it is also something to pay attention to. So the Torah Tamima has a discussion here. He thinks there's actually a fundamental difference between the iser of destroying the other big day kahuna and what the Torah says here about the meal, that in general, similar to perhaps what you might see in Hilchos Shabbos, that the iser presumably would be darach hashchasa, that if you are coming to try to destroy the garment, that's where you have the iser. But here, the iser is going to apply in any event. You're not allowed to tear it at all. So let's say, for example, as the Gemara discusses in Zvachim Adav Tzarihei, that let's say the beged would need to be washed. So it's very difficult because it needs to be washed in the Azara, but if it's Tameh, you can't bring it into the Azara, so you'd have to only bring it in small pieces at a time, where it's less than the shear of the beged. So for the other big day kahuna, you could rip it out and then reconnect it, because that tearing wouldn't be to destroy it. That wouldn't be darach hashchasa. But here, the iser by the big day kahuna, by the me'il specifically, is more absolute, that you shouldn't even rip it at all. And therefore, that's the additional iser. So it's a special zehirus when it comes to the me'il. And then the Torah goes on to describe the asisa al shulav, rimone tcheles. So you make little rimonim, little pomegranates on the hem. The argaman, the salashani al shulav saviv, the pomegranates of the socham saviv. And you're also going to have little bells made out of gold, pomegranates of rimon, al shulay hamil saviv. So here, the relationship between the bells, the pamonim, and the pomegranates here, the rimonim, so here keeps talking about being saviv, being around it. So it's a machlokesh, Rashi and the Ramban, what that means. That according to Rashi, it means that it's the bells are between the rimonim. And according to the Ramban, it means that it's inside, that it's surrounded by them. But okay, so that being a given, so why does the Torah tell us that Aaron has to wear these bells, and his sound will be heard when he comes into the Kodesh, and therefore he's not going to die? So why would he die otherwise? So Rashi writes over here that v'lo yamus, that the issue is, Rashi writes that it's a problem of mechusar begadim. So the Ramban comments that he doesn't think that this is really the place where we're teaching the whole iser of mechusar begadim, which would apply to all the other begadim as well. So rather, the Ramban says that this is telling us actually the tam of the mitzvah, that the purpose of the bells is that there should be a warning that he's coming, that we should know when the Kohen is approaching, they should feel the sound, And that's proper. The Gemara says that, the Gemara says in a few places, that a person should not enter into a house suddenly. Perhaps there's some kind of correlation here to our Hezek Re'iyah Sugyas and our overall privacy considerations. We consider that some synergy. So one should not just burst into a house without a warning. And the Gemara says, even Beiso, even going into his own house, he shouldn't come in suddenly. Kal v'chomer Beis Chavero, for sure not to somebody else's house. So here as well, this is the notion that there should be an announcement that he's coming. You should hear that he's on the way. And perhaps even more so when we're talking about approaching the Beis HaMikdash, is the place of God's Malchus. So this is similar to when talking about Malchus in general, like we find as we're now in Adar, at least one of the Adars. I'm thinking about Purim and the whole emphasis of Esther being afraid to approach Achashverosh without an invitation, without asking Rishus. You can't just burst into the place of the Melech. You have to have some kind of an announcement. So the bells serve that purpose. So as Rav Simcha Zissel Broid comments in the Sefer Som Derech, so this perspective, the difference between Rashi and the Ramban, is that Rashi would see the Lo Yomus here as referring to a Onesh, that basically this person, the Kohen, would be Chayiv Misa for an Avera of a deficient garment. While according to the Ramban, it's more kind of a consequence, that basically it's a sarkana for acting with disregard for the holiness of the place. That becomes a significant issue. It's also noteworthy that the Talmud Yerushalmi in Maseches Yuma, in the seventh parak of Yuma, so the Talmud Yerushalmi has a statement about this idea of a nishma kolo, that his sound should be heard. So Yerushalmi says, Yechaper al kol ahariges hanefesh bishgaga, that this voice that you will hear, this sound that we'll hear from the Kohen, is a kapara, as we indicated before, is one of the examples of a kapara. For what? For a horeg nefesh bishkaga. So that's something we need to figure out a little bit. What exactly is the kesher between this sound and somebody who is ritzeach bishogeg? It's also interesting that he refers to a kol ha-horeg nefesh bishkaga, to the voice of the one who kills bishogeg. So the Torah Tamima has a comment that maybe that's a reference going back to Kayin Vehevel and the Torah's language of kol d'me'achifa. But that's seemingly somewhat tangential. But what exactly is the connection between hearing the sound and ritzeach bishogeg? It's an interesting question. So I thought you could say a little bit al pidarach hadrush, that when we talk about ritzeach bishogeg, so there's a lot to try to understand about the relationship between that and the ir miklat. We know that somebody kills bishogeg, so he gets sent into exile to the city of refuge, to the ir miklat. And there was an interesting invoking of this by Rav Aaron Cutler. They asked Rav Aaron Cutler, who was the great founder of the yeshiva, it's now the largest yeshiva in America, so that wasn't easy to build. And they asked him, you know, why is this the way the world works? You would think that this is not HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. That if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants there to be Talmud Torah in the world, so the people who are most capable and ready to be spending time learning Torah, you'd think God would work it out, that they would be able to learn Torah all the time. And instead, what happens is, when a person becomes a Rosh Yeshiva, a head of an institution like that, so they have no more time for learning. They have to spend all their time going around the world raising money to keep the yeshiva going. So why did God work out the world that way, that the people who really want to be and could be learning his Torah all day, once they reach the heights, now they no longer can do any learning Torah. They have to spend all their time going around raising money. So Rav Aaron reportedly had three answers to that question. I actually only know two. If anyone hears the third, you can let me know. But one answer is a little more intuitive. It says it's a Harbatzas HaTorah, that if you were to only have to stay in your Dalet Amos because there was no need to sustain the yeshiva financially. So then the Rosh Yeshiva would never leave, and all his Torah would be limited only to his shirum. But if he has to go out and raise money, so he goes and speaks in this place and speaks in that place, so that ends up spreading his Torah much further. That's the more intuitive answer. But the other answer he gives, what we want to draw upon here, is that there are some times when, inadvertently, it's not going to happen on purpose, but inadvertently, you'll have that a Rebbe will embarrass one of the students. And if he does that, the Gemara says in Bab Metzia and elsewhere, that Hamalbum Pnei Chaver Beravim is Kilu Shfichas Damim, that if you embarrass somebody, it's as if like you killed them. Now, the Rebbe's not going to do this on purpose, so even if we're calling him a Shofech Damim, it's Shofech Damim B'Shogeg, so he's like a Ritzeach B'Shogeg. If he embarrasses a student carelessly, so then it's like a Ritzeach B'Shogeg, so he should be Chayiv Galus, should be Chayiv to go to the Yom HaKlal. So Rav Aaron explains, so it occasionally happens, the Rebbe is going to embarrass a student. So then, as a kapara, he has to go into exile. He has to leave his yeshiva and wander around the world raising money. So that sounds like a cutesy kind of answer. But I always thought there's something very deep there. And it goes to the whole question of what is the whole notion of a kapara for a tzeach b'shogeg that is connected to the Ir Miklat in general. What does that do to atone for the avera this man did of being careless and allowing Ritzicha to happen because of his negligence? So perhaps the idea is that Ritzach B'Shogeg is somebody who is simply not focused enough on the fragility and the value of human life. He's not evil, he's not looking to hurt anybody, but he's not blameless either. He's in the in-between category. So we have to try to fix that. We have to try to atone for that lack of appreciation and attention to human life. So what do? We have him go to the city, and if he leaves, he has to worry that the relatives are going to kill him. So essentially, here you have somebody who already before this was not enough attuned to the fragility and the sensitivity of human life. And now he's got to think about it all the time. He's got to realize this person is chasing after him. And unless he goes and hides, he's going to be vulnerable to that. So the person who wasn't thinking at all about human life, now he's got to be very focused on the fragility of human life. So too, in the realm of feelings, so if the Rebbe embarrasses a student, so again, he's not looking to make him suffer. He's not evil. It just happens to be Shogeg. But there's a lack of appreciation for how the differential in social status can have an impact. That maybe the Rebbe is saying something that he thinks is just innocent and is just going to go over harmlessly. But it's going to have an impact that's disparate because they're so different. So how do you adjust that? How do you fix that lack of appreciation for the difference in social standing? So the fact that the Rosh Yeshiva now has to go leave his place of home, and he has to go from house to house in various places and say, could you give us a little bit? Could you help me out a little bit? Please, could you help support our yeshiva? So that, bit by bit, having to subjugate, so to speak, himself to other people, having to have a reversal of the whole social standing here, that tends to resensitize a person, and perhaps that's what he's getting here. So maybe you have that here as well a little bit, that if this is about having a much greater sense of awareness and recognizing that you can't just barge into places, so the same type of insensitivity and just kind of pushing your way in, that could lead to unforeseen consequences. So now that you're having the coin with this warning system, that perhaps is somewhat of a corrective and is able to bring about a higher sensitivity that can be somewhat of a kapara.
raise money.
So Ritzias, the fact is they can't do it any other way, that the yeshivas are not able to function unless the people who are... It doesn't work. You try, but you know, it doesn't have the same kind of impact. That's just Ritzias, that... See how every great institution has been built. The people who are at the top have had to invest huge amounts of their time in trying to keep it afloat. So in any event, so maybe that's a little bit going on here. I saw also that Rav Gifter is quoted in the Sefer Pirkei Torah, the Torah of Rav Gifter, that he says something similar, a little bit differently, but he says that that idea from the Gemara that you shouldn't burst into your house without any kind of warning, which is derived from here. So that notion that reflects Derech Eretz, and you see here that Derech Eretz, just a small gesture of civility, is able to be mechaper for even Ritzicha B'Shogeg, because, he says, it's a similar kind of idea, that Ritzicha B'Shogeg, Ritzicha overall, reflects a diminution in the kedusha of a person, of a human being, and anything that starts rebuilding that, anything that shows a greater sensitivity to the dignity of the individual, is something which reverses that trend and starts to be mechaper. He also comments there with Gifter that the idea of a nishma kolo, of the affirmative advantage, that his sound should be heard, he says there, speaking broadly, that when you have people of substance like the Kohen, so every action has an impact. Action should have the sound. You shouldn't do things that are just meaningless. You should do things that have a influence on the world. That doesn't mean that there has to be screaming. It doesn't mean that there should be a shrieking sound. It says it could be a kol d'mamadaka. It could be a faint sound. But to do things that just don't have any impact in the world, that's not what great people do. So the notion of the nishma kolo, that there should be some kind of actual impact, so that's a part of the message, maybe Alpi Darach HaDrush, what the Pasuk is trying to convey to here. So the next Pasuk talks about the tzitz. And here there's a lot of symbolism as well. Yasisa tzitz zohav tohor, upitach talav pituche chosam kodesh la'ashem. So you shall make the plate that sits as a plate made out of gold, and you have to engrave upon it Kodesh LaHashem. There's a whole discussion of the Gemara and Shabbos, and Rishonim talk about how Kodesh LaHashem was written out. It's a little complicated discussion. One line, two lines, one line with one a little bit elevated. But one way or another, so the words have to be put onto there through engraving, which is not the writing. So how exactly they did that, and are you allowed to use metal tools for this? So that was a discussion. The Gemara has the end of Sota, and the Gemara says that they would bring the shamir. They would have that special insect come, and they would have him bite into it in a way that didn't actually make anything disappear, just kind of split apart. So there would basically be an engraving without tools and without causing any loss of material, a very sophisticated approach. So the Taz has a comment in Yeridaya, in Reish Ayin Aleph, that why didn't they just use a press? We spoke about the other day, about the impact of a press. Why don't they just use like a printing press kind of thing to put the words here, and why wouldn't that be good enough? You would think that would be called engraving something onto something. So he says, you see from the fact that they didn't, that that's not called engraving, that's called writing. So you see, printing press, he says, a little bit of a roundabout proof, says you see that a printing press is called writing, and the reason he brings this up is because, he says, there are those who believe that printed Sfarim don't have Kedusha. It's not considered to be Ksivas Divrei Torah, Ksivas Shem Hashem. And he says, Asilitain Asadin, they're going to have to account for that, because that's not the way it is. That really does have Kedusha, and it is considered to be full Ksiva. And he's deriving that, and there's other proofs also, but he's deriving that here from the fact that it's just not suggested as an Eitzah. So the Chavaz Yar is the Tshuva, where he says, doesn't understand why that's so compelling, because you could say it just wasn't an option back then. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily the proof that that would have been considered ksiva. Okay, so the next pasuk goes on to say, "V'samto so al psil tchelas v'haya al hamitznefes al mul pene hamitznefes." Yes, so you should put this on tchelas, that it's going to be over there on the hat, and it's going to be over there in the front. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment here, which modifies a comment that he has elsewhere many times. He talks about the whole symbolism of tchelas. And the Gemara in Menachos talks about how tchelas, the point that we have tchelas playing such a prominent role in various mitzvos, is because tchelas is dom b'l'yam, and the yam is dom b'l'rakia, and the rakia is dom b'l'kiseh hakavod. So we have this whole chain of similarities that ultimately the tchelas evokes the divine throne. So Reb Moshe Feinstein comments in a number of places that it seems pretty roundabout to say this is like that, and that is like that, and that is like that, and it then comes to take you to the Kiseh HaKavod. So he suggests that the message is that when it comes to matters of Kiddusha, you can't just jump. You have to do everything in order, and you can't skip steps. So the Gemara is highlighting each one of these steps in order to show that that's the way Kiddusha works, that you have to build in a progression, and you can't skip steps. So here he quotes that same comment that he makes in other places. But he also says this Kiddush LaHashem that's being put on the Tchelas, that represents some of the steps are big steps. So some things need to be accomplished all at once, and it's a big step, but then you have to keep growing after that. So that's where the steps continue. So in any event, the next pasuk, Lamed Ches, excuse me, tells us, V'hayyal Meitzach Aaron, V'nas Aaron Asavon HaKadoshim Asher Yakdishu B'nei Yisrael L'chol Matnus Kachehim V'hayyal Mitzcho Tavid L'ratzom Lifnei Hashem. So here, Aaron should wear this on his forehead, and this is going to allow him to absorb, to bear any kind of avon that comes in the context of the kachim. So this idea that he's wearing it on his head all the time, so the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, and Daf Yud Beis, the Gemara says that you have to check your tefillin all the time. And that's a kal v'chomer from the tzitz. Because here you see the tzitz only had one azkara, and yet you had to be aware of it all the time. You had to check it, you had to be on top of it, as it was on top of him. So tefillin, which has many azkaras, so kal v'chomer all the more so. You have to be aware of, and you have to check your tefillin constantly when they're on. So Tosfos in Maseches Yuma, on Daf Ches Amud Aleph, Tosfos asks, it's a little bit of an interesting kal v'chomer, do we really assume that tefillin are more kodesh than the tzitz? It has more azkara, so therefore that makes it more holy? There are other ways to look at it. We do find a lot of halachos that would seem to treat the tzitz as holier than tefillin. And one detail to look at is the fact that you can look at the fact that the azkara on the tzitz was visible, and the azkaras in the tefillin are all wrapped up and hidden. So maybe that's already a difference. Why would we assume that the tefillin are really more kodesh than the tzitz? So Tosfos over there says that this is not a real limud, it's not a real drasha, this is really a din d'rabbanan. This notion of not having hesach hadas by tefillin is a din d'rabbanan. So the Torah Tmima notes that many say, not like this Tosfos, who said the din of hesach hadas by tefillin is also deraisa, both by the tzitz and by the tefillin is deraisa. It's a discussion among the Rishonim. There are some who maintain it's d'rabbanan, some maintain it's deraisa. The Talmid Rebbeinu Yonah, the Gemara in Brachos, and Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, and Daf Be'arif, he writes that the Isser is actually d'rabbanan when it comes to tefillin, And therefore, the nature of the Isser is really about Chok and Kalos Rosh. So the person shouldn't not just be distracted, but that he shouldn't be frivolous. He shouldn't have an attitude that's really inappropriate for tefillah when he's wearing tefillin. So it's interesting whether this Isser is deraisa or derabbanan, because it does a lot to affect how we perform the mitzvah of tefillin. We have great limitations on the mitzvah of tefillin nowadays because we're concerned that we might wear the tefillin in a way that is disrespectful, among other things. So, in our Torah, it sounds like the mitzvah of tefillin is actually much more expansive than we do nowadays. We only wear tefillin during davening, during shacharis, and not all day. Part of that is because we don't want to be mesiach das, we don't want to treat the tefillin disrespectfully. There are different components to it, but in general, this idea that we shouldn't be frivolous, we shouldn't be engaged in tzchok and kalos rosh when tefillin are on, that seems to be a very important din, whether it's d'raisa or d'rabbanan. So by Simon Shlita, the Sefer Mir Baruch, he quotes from Avraham Yafin, who makes an interesting point, that here we see this then applies to the Kohen, and yet the Kohen himself is immersed in Kedusha. And he's in the context of holiness all the time here. And the idea that he's going to get distracted and have a Kalos Rosh or have any kind of a Hesach Hadas regarding his Tzitz specifically, even though he's got all this Kedusha going on, is surprising. So he suggests that in Hanami, that's the point, that we can't rely on externals in order to keep us focused. And in fact, sometimes that's the problem, that when we are on the high, so to speak, with everything else surrounding us being so holy in of itself, that sometimes you let your guard down, and that's when you're actually most vulnerable. You find that in a few other places, that Kedushas Levi, or Levi Yitzchak of Radichev, in his Sefer, he has a kuntres on the Zechiros. And he talks about the whole question of why we have the Zechira of the Egel Hazav. And he suggests it's for next week's parasha, so we'll talk more about that. But he understands that one of the messages of the Egel Hazav is that here you would think that the Jews at that point, after Matan Torah, that the level of spirituality would have been so high, they wouldn't have been susceptible at all to such an avera. And yet, look what happened. You see how vulnerable they were. So what does that show you? That shows you that you're never safe without internally deciding to pay attention. And that's perhaps also the message here, that you shouldn't just rest on your laurels and think, okay, the environment's going to take care of me. But you have to be on top of it. You have to have your own focus and your own zahiris. It's also related to the idea that the Gemara tells us in Erechin, the Gemara in the middle of Erechin, has the notion that the tzitz is machaper also on ozus panim, on arrogance. So that's also related to the person who is too confident because of what they have already accomplished, or even worse, because of just what's surrounding them that's not from their own accomplishment. So that leads to problems. So to have something that you have to be very careful about, you have to pay great attention to make sure that you're not going to disrespect. So that's a good way to counteract the midah of arrogance, and perhaps that's also a part of the message. So I just want to say a few more words about this idea of the kaparas that come from this aliyah, and specifically that gemara over there in the middle of Erechin. So that gemara, those gemaras over there which talk about the Big Day Kahuna and their various kaparas, they also talk about Lashon Hara. That's where the main concentration of Divrei Chazal in the Talmud Bavli about Hilchos Lashon Hara, even though there are a few number of other passages throughout Shas, but you have in the Talmud Bavli a lot specifically over there in the middle of Erechin. So the Gemara says over there regarding the Me'il that we were just reading about, that the Me'il is Mechaper on Lashon Hara. And it's interesting, you have to figure out exactly how that connection is made. The Gemara has the language, it relates also to the bells, and that Yavo Davar Shebekol, Yechaper al Davar Shebekol, that let that which makes a sound come and atone for averus done through sound. So that's an interesting connection. You still have to figure out exactly what that means. So some point to the notion of the tcheles, that perhaps is the key here. And the Kliyakar suggests that the tcheles evoking the yam, so that is why there is a kapara for Lashon Hara, because it says just like the yam doesn't breach the boundaries, it stays in its place, so too your mouth shouldn't breach its boundaries, shouldn't say things that it shouldn't be saying. So first of all, the whole idea of associating the yam specifically with that idea of being controlled and being contained is interesting. So a little bit of synergy, we kind of mentioned this yesterday on our Gemara in Baba Basra, and Zayin and Bebeis, where the Gemara talks about the sand on the beach being protective. And it sounds like from the language of the Gemara and Rashi that it's protective of the ocean, that the sand is there keeping the ocean in place. So that notion that the ocean is careful about its boundaries, we could have a little bit of synergy to connect to that. But I think also maybe what the Kliyakar is getting at, especially if you look at the role of water and the notion of the ocean being in its boundaries, and especially thinking about what would happen if it wasn't in its boundaries, especially nowadays when there's such focus on climate change concerns and tsunamis and shifting borders at the ocean. So that becomes something to even be more acutely aware of, just what would happen if the oceans don't stick to their borders. So water is a good muscle, in a sense, for the power of speech, because we know that water is crucial for life. We need it to be sustained on a very frequent basis. But also, water, when it's not controlled or contained, can be among the most dangerous forces on Earth. Water can be terribly threatening. And speech is like that also. So speech is considered so holy and so fundamental because of the power that it has. Achayim v'amavis v'yad halashon. But it's all contingent on us being able to be careful about it and being able to keep it under restraint. So if that were to fail, that's where we have problems. So perhaps there is a comparison to be drawn between water and the context of the sea and speech, and they both need to have this restraint in order to be able to have the functionality that is so basic to human existence. That's one possibility. But Rav Schneer Kotler, we mentioned before Rav Aaron Kotler, so his son Rav Schneer took over the Lakewood Yeshiva after Rav Aaron passed away. And Rav Schneer published an article in one of the journals in Kol HaTorah where he also focuses on the tcheles as the aspect that brings about the kapara, and he says, a little bit similar to what we said before from Rav Moshe Feinstein, of noting that language of the Gemara and that whole progression of the tcheles dom liyam, the dam dom l'rakia, and the rakia dom l'kisei akavon. So the whole experience that you have there is of a ever-broadening perspective. At first, you're just looking at the tcheles, and then you pull back a little bit, and you see, oh, the tcheles is like the sea, and then you pull back a little bit, and you see the sky, and you pull back more, and you see the kisei hakavod. Then you start off very zoomed in, and the more you bring in the full picture, the more you realize what is there overall. And he notes that that is the issue when it comes to Lashon Hara. That regarding Lashon Hara, so if we understand, as many do, without getting into the whole discussion right now, if this is the only translation, but we understand that Lashon Hara includes that which is true. You say something factual, So you are still potentially in violation of the Issur Lashon Hara. So why should that be if what you're saying is true? So there are a lot of ways to explain it, but one way to explain it is that you're just not seeing the whole picture. So yes, you're seeing something that is correct, but it doesn't really tell you the truth in terms of giving you the whole sense of what's going on. So to that extent, it's comparable to a camera that zoomed in too close. So you just see this one negative episode, and you think that it reflects fully on who the person is, but if the camera would pull back more, so then you'd see more. If it pulled back more, you'd see more than that, then you'd ultimately see the whole picture. So you recognize that there's a lot more to see. So that is a good corrective, once again, for this too narrow perspective that comes with Lashon Hara, being able to have the broader perspective that the Tcheles represents. That is what teaches us how really to see things, and that's one way in which the Me'il can be a kapara. It's evocative of the idea that many, many commentaries on Pirkei Avos have, that they all hit on the same point, that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says we should judge people favorably has the language Havedon es kol ha'adam l'chavstchos, that not just we should judge everyone favorably, but have you done as called ha'adam? So the commentaries ask, what does it mean ha'adam? Why don't we say kol adam, judge everyone favorably? What is judge all of the person favorably? What does that mean? So many, many suggest the same idea, which has real practical implications as far as how Dan L'Chavschos works, that you might think that what Dan L'Chavschos requires is that I should put a charitable interpretation on what I'm looking at right now. And then it becomes a question whether that's reasonable or not. But perhaps no. Perhaps Dan L'Chavschos doesn't just mean that you interpret this positively. Maybe it's not always possible for you to interpret positively what's in front of you. But the Mishnah actually says you should do more than that. Havidan is called Ha'adam L'Chavschos. That it's not just about this, it's about the person in their totality. So if you can see what it is that is also going on with this individual, it's not just this one thing that you're laser focused on, but there's so much more to them. So to see all that in perspective, so that gives us a whole different way to see things, and that's what it means. So even if an episode that you're focused on right now, there's just no way to interpret it positively, that does not free you from the obligation of being Dan L'Chavschos. You have to still have a broader picture and understand that the Mishnah is not just saying, look at this positively, it's saying, look at the person positively. It's saying that you should understand the totality of what goes into them. And that was perhaps a part of the message here as well. Lubavitcher Rebbe pointed out, he had an extra spin on this, that when you say judge the whole person, so if you look at the rest of the Mishnah says, Asei lecha rav, uknei lecha chaver, v'habidan es kol adam l'chavschos. So the question becomes, what's the relationship between all of those parts? So you should acquire, you should make for yourself a Rebbe, and you should acquire a friend somehow, buy a friend, whatever it takes, and judge everyone favorably. So he says, what it means is you should judge the totality of the person and recognize that a person is very much affected by his social environment and by his educational history. So take all of that into account. So see the picture as broadly as possible. So understand that it's important to pick a good Rebbe and to have a good Chevra, because all of that contributes to who the person is. And that is a part of this process of having done as Kol Ha'adam. So that is related to the whole concept of Lashon Hara. A person has a very narrow focus on just one detail. He's zoomed in way too close so that he doesn't see everything else. And that becomes a very skewed perspective. So the Tcheles is able to hopefully counteract that. So that's another interpretation. But there's more to say about this, just to say for a few more minutes, that there is a very fundamental distinction that the Gemara makes, which is very interesting to think about. That the Gemara picks up on the fact that you may probably be aware, I'm sure you're aware, that there are other kaparas that are invoked for Lashon Hara. And this is not the most well-known, right? The idea that the Me'il is Mechaper for the Lashon Hara, so we would probably think first of different kaparas for Lashon Hara that we'll read about in a few weeks. You know, Tezriya and Metzora talk about Saras, this bodily affliction that was caused by spiritual deficiencies, that's a kapara for Lashon Hara. So, which is it? Is it the Me'il or is it Saras? So, it's not a fatal question. It could be both. But the Gemara does raise the issue, and the Gemara draws a distinction. The Gemara says that it depends, that Be'ahoni Ma'isov, that's where you need the Tzaras, below Ahoni Ma'isov, that's where the Me'il. In other words, if you are successful in your Lashon Hara, so then that's worse, and that's what the Tzaras is needed to atone for, while the Me'il is there to atone for Lashon Hara that was not successful. So that is a fascinating distinction that has very significant implications, because what exactly does that mean to say successful Lashon Hara and not successful Lashon Hara, one type of kapara for one type of kapara for the other? What's going on with that? So first of all, what does it mean successful and not successful? So Rashi on the Gemara talks about successful Lashon Hara meaning that you caused people to fight because of it, which is interesting in itself, because that actually is what, in the Rambam's terminology, which we don't have to necessarily be limited to, it could be that other Rishonim saw it differently, but in the Rambam's terminology, that would fit more with how he understood Rechilus. That the Rambam understood that Lashon Hara is about disparaging people, and Rechilus is about telling somebody what others are saying about him. And the concern seems to be with Rechilus that you're going to provoke fights. That if I tell you this guy said you're a jerk, so that's Rechilus, because you're going to get angry at him. If I tell you that guy's a jerk, that's Lashon Hara. If I tell you he said you're a jerk, so that's Rechilus. So it's interesting that Rashi understands here that successful Lashon Hara is about starting fights, because that's more what you understand when it comes to Rechilus. But okay, so it's consistent actually with the idea that was Daf Yomi not so long ago, comes up in the context of Moed Katan and the Menuda, person who was in Cherem. So the notion that Saras is a kapara for Lashon Hara actually works with that, because Chazal have the idea that it makes sense. The person who has Saras is going to have to be sent out of the Machane, is going to have to be isolated and quarantined, social distanced. So the Gemara says that he caused division among people. He got people to hate each other. So as a kapara, he has to get a taste of his own medicine. He should be isolated. He should be quarantined and separated from other people. So when a person actually succeeded in having that kind of an impact, whether you say he started fights or he got people to think less of each other so they wouldn't have that kind of association, so one way or another, it makes sense that that should be fixed, that should be atoned for through that kind of a quarantining, that kind of a isolation. So if he was successful, if he actually had that impact, so then Saras is Mechaper. But if he wasn't successful, so he still needs a kapara, and that kapara comes from the Me'il. And there, so it also fits with language of the Gemara and Erechin, that the Me'il is there to be mechaper on the kol itself, to be mechaper on the sound. So maybe we could break it down into the sound and the effect. And that kind of highlights the idea that when it comes to Lashon Hara, there are at least two components to the Aveira. And this is something that Rabbeinu Yonah highlights in Shari Tshuva, that Lashon Hara involves the negative impact on the subject. If I said something bad about someone, he might get hurt, he might suffer. And it also corrodes the soul. It's bad for the speaker, for the person to indulge in negativity and to have a bad perception of the person he's speaking about. So that's itself bad. So if you think about it, I hope I'm explaining it clearly, all the parts kind of line up here. that when a person is successful with his lashon hara and he actually causes harm, so then he should have to pay a price that's bigger. He should have to be isolated from everyone else. He caused the impact of dividing people. So as a kapara, he also needs to be separated out. But even if he doesn't succeed in inflicting any harm, but he still harmed himself, he still corroded his own soul by engaging in negativity, by having that very skewed and jaundiced perspective towards other people, so then he needs to fix his perspective and he needs to be mechaper for his kol. And that fits with what Rav Shneur Kotler was saying, that the me'il is a kapara on perspective, that it connects you to tcheles, and it puts you into a different frame of mind. And if you see, you think about it, you see all these parts kind of line up as far as how the kapara works. So again, this actually has a very significant real-world applications in the whole notion of honey mice or low honey mice. It's not just for this process of kapara in the very lofty sense, but it has very real nafkaminas for Hilchos Ben Adam L'Chaveru. And there is a very often quoted machlokes, very well-known machlokes, which is not well appreciated. The nuances are not often properly relayed. So let's take a minute just to make sure that we're fully aware, because it very much relates to this, that there was a tremendous machlokes between Rabbi Saul Salanter and the Chafetz Chaim, which was so significant that legend has it, it's been relayed, that the Chafetz Chaim refused to give, Rabbi Saul Salanter refused to give a haskama to the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. That here the Chafetz Chaim wrote the Sefer of the Laws of Lashon Hara, and Rabbi Saul Salanter was the founder of the Musar movement. He was the one who was most focused on trying to get people to care about how they treat each other. So it would be a natural fit that he should write a approbation for the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. But legend has it that he declined. And that the reason he declined was that he said, there's one ruling, there's one psak in the Sefer that I disagree with, so I can't sign on to it. And the Talmidim said to him, Sir Rabbi, just write the Haskama anyway, and you'll put there a footnote. By the way, on page 326, there's a psak I disagree with, I think it should be such and such. So he said, nobody reads the Haskamas anyway, so I'll just see my stationery, and they'll see that at the beginning of the Sefer, they'll think I agree with everything, and I can't sign on to this, I can't agree with this one psak. So it's an interesting question if the story is true. It's quoted like this in a number of Sfarim. It seems to have a lot of basis to it. I will say, I discovered by accident once, it's a little bit of a kasha on the story, that the tshuvas of Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, Rabbi Yitzchak Petterberger, who was the Talmud Muvak of Rabbi Shaul Salanter. So if there was anyone he would think would have a haskama from Rabbi Shaul Salanter, it was Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser. He was the greatest student of Rabbi Shaul Salanter. So in his hakdama, he thanks everybody who he is grateful to, and he has a whole paragraph there about his great Rebbe, Rabbi Shaul Salant. And he says there, and even though I don't have a haskama from him, because it was not his darach to give haskamas, but he was very supportive. So maybe that's a kasha on the story. Maybe nobody had haskamas from Rishol Salanter. I don't know. But in any event, so this is the story that Rishol refused to give a haskama to the Chafetz Chaim because of this one controversial ruling. So what's the controversial ruling that was such an issue? So I'll say the oversimplified version, and then we'll try to clarify it a little bit. But the oversimplified version is that supposedly the Chafetz Chaim wrote that if you speak Lashon Hara about somebody, so then it's an Avera ben Adam L'Chaveru, so before Yom Kippur you're going to have to do tshuva, and you're going to have to ask Mechila. That's what happens. You do an Avera ben Adam L'Chaveru, you have to ask Mechila. But what happens if the person didn't know? This is an Avera you can do without the person being aware of it. So let's say you spoke Lashon Hara, and they weren't aware of it. So if you're going to tell them, you can ask Mechila, you're going to hurt their feelings terribly. It's going to be onas tevarim. You're going to really devastate them by telling them about the Lashon Hara they weren't aware of. So it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim, you should do it anyway. You should ask for Mechila, even though they didn't know about the Lashon Hara before, and now you're going to really make them upset, but you have to do it in order to ask for Mechila. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, Chas v'shalom, how could you do that? That's a nos dvarim. You're going to really hurt their feelings. What right do you have to inflict onas dvarim of such a great degree just so you can get a kapara? Not allowed to do that. So it's a big discussion in later svarim, who was right and how do you understand this? And many thought that Rabbi Yisrael was right. There's a lot to say about this, and I won't go into all the details right now. But we mentioned Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Shneur Cutler already, so I'll mention Rav Aaron Cutler one more time. That it says in one of the Rav Aaron Cutler biographies, if I remember correctly, that he had said that Rav Yisrael was right about this, that you should not ask Mechila in this case. So they pointed out to him that the Chafetz Chaim didn't make up his position on his own. It's based on Rabbeinu Yonah. He makes a reference to Shai Tshuva. So if this position really goes back to Rabbeinu Yonah, so it means really a Rishon said it. So how could Rav Yisrael argue on Rabbeinu Yonah, argue against the Rishon? So to that, the story was that Rav Aaron responded that he said, Rav Yisrael Tanahu Palik. An adaptation of the phrase from the Gemara, that Rav Yisrael was on such a madrega, he was like a Rishon, that on these issues he was such an authority that he was on the stature of the Rishonim, he could argue on Rabbeinu Yonah also. So there's a lot written about this, but what gets a little bit overlooked is that even if we acknowledge, as a number of poskim do, that the halacha is probably like Rav Yisrael Salanter, and that you should not ask for mechila in a way that's going to require you to tell somebody something that they don't know about, it's going to hurt their feelings. So let's assume that that's the case. Rav Asher Weiss has a piece about this in a Sefer in Vayikra, where he says he thinks they're both wrong. Because he thinks that the Chafetz Chaim is wrong because he shouldn't ask for mechila, but he thinks that Rav Yisrael is wrong because the implication of Rav Yisrael's psak is that it's not a kula, it's a chumrah. Shouldn't think, okay, so I don't have to ask Mechila. He says, no, you can't ask Mechila because it's going to be too hurtful. And you're stuck, so you can't get a kapara because you can't ask Mechila. So it's really a bad position to be in. So that's why Lashon Hara is a good avera to avoid. But you shouldn't get yourself in this position because there's no real way to ask for Mechila. So Rav Asher said he thought that both positions were wrong, that the Chafetz Chaim is wrong that you shouldn't ask for Mechila. And that Rav Shaul was wrong, that you're not stuck either, that this is, you could do tshuva without asking mechila in such a case, that you'll get a kapara without having to ask mechila. But, in any event, what gets overlooked here a little bit, and just to put the Chafetz Chaim in a little bit more context, even if we don't accept his opinion, that's a discussion, but even if you're not going to accept his opinion, and I certainly understand the idea that we don't want to go around turning people's feelings in such a way, but what gets overlooked is that the Chafetz Chaim doesn't say that, oh, if I just happen to say some nasty comment to somebody about a third party and nothing else comes of it, that I should go and come to that third party and say, you should know that yesterday I made a nasty comment about you to somebody and I hope you're mochel me, because that will indeed hurt their feelings for no reason. The Chafetz Chaim specifically said that there's a distinction to be made here, that if your Lashon Hara was successful, that if you cause damage with what you said, so then, even if they don't know about it, so then you're going to have to ask for Mechila. But if what you said didn't have any effect, nobody's listening to you anyway, it didn't actually have an impact, so then you shouldn't ask for Mechila. So it helps to contextualize a little bit. The Chafetz Chaim is not saying that you should go around telling everybody of every little remark that you made that they don't know about, which would really be pretty extreme. He's saying that when it was really a hani maisav, essentially, when you really did some damage to this person's reputation, and there's really harm out there, so then you're going to have to ask for mechila. So that's a little bit more understandable if you think about it, because let's say you're staying at somebody's house, and you trash their basement, and then you leave, and they haven't had a chance to check the basement yet, so you say goodbye, and you say, well, what they don't know won't hurt them, so I'm not going to tell them that I destroyed their basement and asked for mechila. So you understand that if you cause them real damage out there that they may not know about right now, you're going to have to get their forgiveness for it, even if it means there's going to be an awkward conversation, and you're going to have to tell them. We're going to run out of time in a second. So if that's the case, so, you know, here too, the Chafetz Chaim is not saying about the remarks that we all make that we regret. He's saying that if you actually do real harm to somebody that's out there causing them problems, so then even though it's going to be a difficult conversation, you may have to ask mechila. But lashon hara that's begather lo ahani maisa, where you didn't actually do any harm, so then that you're going to that you don't have to ask mechila for. That you should just do tshuva ben adam l'makom. You should just do the normal kind of Yom Kippur tshuva. So here, I think that's very instructive based on what we see in this context as well. That, first of all, it's a big contextualization of Chafetz Chaim to understand this psak is not necessarily as extreme as it is presented. But also, it's interesting with Futner, there's a Sefer Zikara that was printed from a Futner, which has Torah from him directly as well. So there, he has a shtickle where he disagrees with Chafetz Chaim from both directions. He hits him from both parts. He says he thinks that the Reb Sorel is right, you can't ask Mechila in such a case. But he says he thinks the distinction is wrong, that the idea that there's some Lashon Hara that doesn't have an impact, so there's no Lashon Hara that doesn't have an impact. Because every Lashon Hara you're going to say detracts from the V'yahavta L'Reich HaKamocha out there in the words of this person. So there's no such thing as harmless Lashon Hara. So it's always a problem against this guy. But still, you can't ask Mechila anyway. So he hits him from both directions. He thinks that the distinction isn't true, but either way, you can't ask for Mechila. But what the Chafetz Chaim is really saying, it's a little bit supported by this Gemara, that there are two categories, Ahani Maisav and Lo Ahani Maisav, and that they're not always going to be equal. But a very crucial component here is that even if you don't actually have any real-world harm, that even if you could say, maybe it's not always clear when it's true and when it's not true, there's always effects that don't show themselves until later that you don't know about. But let's say we could verifiably assume that what you said had absolutely no impact. Nobody paid attention to you and nobody cared and it didn't end up changing anything as far as this person's reputation. Let's posit for a second that you could know that for sure. Still, there's still a need for a tshuva, still a need for a kapara. So that's also very interesting, and that's what this parsha is reflecting, according to the Gemara, that there's two components to the avera of Lashon Hara. There is the impact that you may have in the real world, that you may cause this person problems, and that would have to be fixed if that happens. But even if there is no real world impact, even if you don't change his reputation or cause a fight or do any kind of perceptible harm, but you are still corroding your soul by engaging in this kind of conversation, and that needs a kapara. That's going to need to be fixed one way or another. And that's something that the Gemara says. The Gemara here in Erechin says needs a kapara, so the Mi'il reflects that. And in all the ways that we've seen, it comes to correlate to whatever internal issues there are that leads you to speak this way about a person. And we'll also just close by noting that the Gemara also says that Talmud Torah is a kapara for Lashon Hara, presumably in that sense also, that if I harm a person, I can't just do tshuva by learning Torah and say, okay, now I'm off the hook. We're talking about the internal issue that needs to be fixed. That can be fixed through Talmud Torah. And some of them are scheming on the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, unlike the Shlomo Salanta, there were others who did write Haskamas, so some of them write that this idea that Gemara says that Talmud Torah is a kapara, he says, unfortunately, we know that there are Talmud Chachamim out there who still speak Lashon Hara, that apparently doesn't work so well, that the idea that Talmud Torah is supposed to protect against Lashon Hara. So they write in Haskamah that it must be, it's not just any Talmud Torah, but that it's specifically Talmud Torah about Lashon Hara, that if you learn about these topics, your sensitivity will be greater, and that will help fix the future instance, you're not going to be so likely to speak Lashon Hara. So, in that vein, it goes back to what we started with, learning this parsha, learning about the Migdei Kahuna, and especially how they connect, like Chazal is telling us, to these midos of Lashon Hara and other related averos, is going to have a real-world effect on us, even if we're not wearing Migdei Kahuna, but they're going to help correct whatever issues we have in our internal makeup, in our perspective, in our midos. And Kedi Hiratzon, we should have very careful attention to these parshas, to the parsha this week specifically, and it should have that effect of elevating and transforming our personality so that our day-to-day behavior reflects it. We wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, only good things.